Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished up watching Douglas Sirk's 1955 classic, All That Heaven Allows.
Yeah.
What a movie.
This is a romantic film.
Yes.
I was going to say rom-com because we just watched a rom-com last week.
Yeah. This is a stark difference.
No,
to...
this is more of a drama, really.
Yeah.
But what a drama. I thoroughly enjoyed this film.
Yeah.
I suppose we should start with the synopsis. I mean, it's really just a run-of-the-mill film. You're doing a synopsis this week.
Alrighty. So basically, we presented the story of this... I wouldn't even go so far as to say elderly. It's a woman in her, you know, maybe late 40s, early 50s, I'd say.
She would probably fit in the MILF category.
Yeah, well, okay. We're presented with
porn,
the...
Of a porn site.
We're presented with this MILF. And with this older woman who, you know, she's a widow and she has two grown children and things. And is kind of toying with the idea of getting back into the dating pool. And when that's when she meets her gardener.
She'd be mature category.
You're trying to find where she fits in porn.
Yeah, because she's not like granny porn.
No.
She's not
that old.
She's like upper echelon MILF. She's immature.
Yeah, yeah.
Mature
she's like
section.
50s.
Yeah.
Early
That's
50s.
Mature. That's
yeah.
mature category.
So this mature lady starts up a relationship with her gardener, who is a younger man, and much to the chagrin of her children and the people in her local community. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Pretty much. It's a really base and simple story, but executed fucking flawlessly.
Yeah. The I think we should break this session down into characters, and then let's talk about the characters first.
Yep.
Because the story is exactly that. It's very
yeah.
simple. But what makes this work is that especially Ron, the gardener.
Yep. Played perfectly by Rock Hudson.
Yeah. Is arresting. His performance is fucking arresting.
Yeah.
We were having the vapors.
Yeah, honestly, after watching Rock Hudson in this film, I think I might be gay for Rock Hudson. Like, he is a dreamboat of a man. I don't know if I'm in... I quite possibly could be in love with Rock Hudson or Ron.
Ron the character, right?
Yeah, it is Ron. Ron is
assisted by Rock.
Yeah. His manliness.
So, his character is... I mean, the interesting thing about this film is all of these white middle-class people, there's no black people around, there's only white people in this town.
Yeah.
Which is the universal backlot.
Yes.
You pointed out.
Yeah.
Which was familiar because of...
We're in Hill Valley.
Hill Valley. It's so awesome.
Yeah, yeah. The town square is the Hill Valley town square, yeah.
Anyway.
Side note. Yeah.
So everybody there is... Their idea of success is money, big house.
Yeah.
Fanciful career.
How much money you make and, you know, what school your kids go to. It's all...
How good is your furniture? How great are your clothes?
Are you a member of the country club? Yeah.
Just fucking bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in stark contrast, you have Ron, who is the biggest man out of all of them.
He is the local gardener for them, and he lives out at his father's old nursery in a shack. He does not care.
He does not care. Well, he does care. But I think, like, you could boil his philosophy down. I think they use this as, just don't create importance around things that aren't important. And
yeah.
That's a bit of a wishy-washy thing to say when you're just kind of like, well, what's important?
Yeah, but his philosophy is be true to yourself. And he finds contentment in his own life and in his work and not in his material possessions and how other people view him. Yeah.
And naturally you would fall in love with a man like that.
Well, yeah.
That's exactly what Kerry does.
Yes, yes.
But then there's the drama is... How free are you to make a decision based on love when everybody else is so...
Versus these outside pressures weighing in. Are you able to change your perception on how you were to live your life?
Yeah.
And it's actually really interesting because for the majority of the film, we are presented this from Carrie's point of view, like her, whether or not she is willing to adjust her way of life from the upper class kind of structured society life to a more free and easygoing, calm existence that Ron has. But we're also given brief instances where it is that conundrum is presented to Ron. And we are actually given a nice, even-handed film where we are presented, like, all right, it would be a pain for her to change her life. It would also be a pain for him to change his life. Where do you find the middle ground? And it's really wonderful.
Well, I feel like he is coming from a place where he is content and happy with his lifestyle. If he was to be more ambitious and start going for the things that everybody else seems to covet.
He joins the country club, if he goes to the cocktail parties,
he'll deteriorate as a person and he'll become unhappy, therefore he won't.
Yeah, which is why they make the decision that Carrie will ultimately live with him and things, because she is more than happy to adopt his lifestyle and kind of move out that way, yeah.
Whereas with her, it felt like that she was... she was never really given the opportunity to move away from the, you know, middle class, upper crust, white suburban lifestyle.
She was born into it and married into it, and it's just, that's all she has known. And now she has been, with this man entering her life, she's presented this whole new opportunity of, like, this is what life can be. You can go other, you know, take other roads, and, you know, she's still, you know, young and you know, has
her life. Like, mature.
Yeah.
This is like an age category now.
What was I saying?
I don't know. It's we're kind of like we're fiddling around with
a little bit.
We're fiddling around, but
I could ask, like, what was it to you that made this film stand out? Like, what did you enjoy? What made you enjoy this film?
Ron. It's refreshing to see a character like that. We were talking about last week the kind of cliches that that what is it called? I know where I'm going. Cliches and the kind of tropes that a rom-com or a romantic film will give you. And I felt that in that film, the love interest was kind of placid, like a flaccid, shitty cock.
Yeah, with weird, fucked up teeth.
Yeah, but this guy was somebody that kind of jumps out at you, and you can't, like, it's just so fucking refreshing to have a person that is going against just the general, like, I guess, Western outlook on what success is.
Yeah, the very kind of capitalist kind of...
Yeah, it is capitalism. Capitalism. This guy is...
It's very white bread idea of living, I guess. Like, very, you know, the white picket fence. And
I think we're a bit flustered.
Yeah, we are.
This guy from fucking Ron, man.
Yeah.
It's like, I think I'm in love. I can't explain it.
Yeah. I just have this... I have butterflies in my stomach whenever I think of him. Oh, God.
We could try and focus here, man.
But yeah, no, I think what made me connect to it is the idea of the escape, because we're presented the life that Carrie has been living, and it's the way, I'm sure it is a fine life for those that choose it, and I mean, Carrie herself has chosen that life, you know, all of her mature years, and but the way we're presented it is... It's a very constrictive lifestyle, and it doesn't seem to be one that she is enjoying. And all of the people we're introduced to are fucking cunts. Like, yeah, there's no other way to say
horrible.
It. And it's what made me engage with the film is seeing this woman who's kind of oppressed by this life that she's living, getting an opportunity to escape out of it and actually find fun and life again. And it was really wonderful story. Great entertainment to watch.
But in addition, I was kind of blown away by all of the lighting and the framing of this film.
Yeah.
Who's the director?
Douglas Sirk. I had heard of him, but I'd never seen any of his films. He's a classic American filmmaker from the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
This guy fucking knows how to shoot a conversation.
Yeah.
The film shines the most is when you have interactions between two people.
Yep.
In a single room. And there is what comes to mind is the sequence in which Ron and Carrie are kind of they've developing a friendship and a love for each other, and Ron is trying to express that by going like, "Yes, I will actually rebuild my father's old mill into a livable home, so that we don't have to if we were to live together."
Yeah, a home for us.
Yeah, we won't have to live in a greenhouse, but an actual house.
Yeah. And then it's also, that's the same way he proposes to her. He says,
yeah.
You know, I love you, will you marry me?
But the wonderful thing is, there's this back and forth between the two characters. Should I leave my lifestyle, says Carrie. And what's going on is you have this warm orange glow of the fire.
At the beginning of the scene when it's very tender and close, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and they're really fostering each other's love. Like, they're really going for it. The proposal happens. And then... Then, as soon as she realizes she's kind of got this fear about leaving the lifestyle, what it's going
to
mean,
what this is going to mean to
how it's going to how it's going to hurt people, she moves. Ron moves to the window, which all of a sudden I think they both actually move to the window, and they all of a sudden
she moves first.
They're drenched in blue light.
Yeah, they've moved from the warm reds of the fire out over to the window, and this blues and blacks.
It's fucking amazing, like. The idea that you're going to... I mean, this happens all the time, but it's just really...
Using the lighting and the colour within the film to help enhance the mood and the tension within the scene.
Yeah, plus the idea that you're going to move the character at certain times around the room.
Yeah.
Framing them in certain ways that's going to reflect visually what they're going through in their heads. And it's just fucking the best viewing ever.
Yeah.
I think, like Fincher does that all the time.
Yeah, David Fincher.
I think I watched... Every Frame of Painting
about movement with David Fincher. Yeah,
yeah, and they were saying the same thing in those in the Seven scene. A scene in Seven.
Yeah, it's the one between Morgan Freeman, Brad Pitt, and Ali Ermey. The and how he manages to get character movement to bring people into the scenes, and he lets character movement dictate camera movement, not the other way around.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's so fucking fresh, and it's working on such a sophisticated level. You don't even notice what's happening. You have to actually be like prepared to think about now. Why is this frame moving now?
Yeah.
And why is there this new color palette? What's going on? Like, that shit gets my dick hard nearly as hard as Ron.
Yeah. Well, we're also that's the first scene where we really noticed it, but it also kind of pops up again throughout the film. Again in the scene where Carrie introduces Ron to her children and kind of explains the scenario that, you know, yes, I'm going to be marrying this younger man, and their kind of reactions. And then I think it's the scene later in that evening when after there's the incident at the cocktail party, and Ron's not going to fit in. And they come home, and he drops Carrie off home, and she has the confrontation with her son, who says, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. And it's framed very close and intimate at the beginning of the scene, where it's the mother and the son having a very intimate conversation about relationships, and then there's a deterioration of their of their conversing, that they begin to split apart, to the extent that the son ends up behind a separate scene, a screen of mesh, before he eventually leaves the frame. And it's like there's this very clear dividing lines that he puts in, and it's fucking masterful filmmaking.
Yeah, I think those two scenes are the standouts.
Yeah.
It's probably happening all over the place as well.
But yeah, but those were the two, like, real standouts that you notice. It is...
Yeah, if you're listening to this and then you want to watch it, then just look out for those scenes and study that shit, because it's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it is... No other way to say it. It is masterful filmmaking. It's... Yeah, holy crap.
Having said that, we're talking about the ending and they get together and shit.
Yeah.
It's not really... Everyone's fucking...
Yeah, it's a romantic film in the 1950s. You know that they are going to get together. It's... And here's the thing, like, I was so emotionally invested in this film that if they had not gotten together, I would have been genuinely bummed. Like, I would have been really upset about that.
Yeah.
So, this film fucking got me on every single level.
And usually, when you know that, would you say that if a film is doing that, then it's removing the stakes?
Yeah.
But then I didn't experience that removal of stakes.
I think that's because we became emotionally invested in the journey of the characters.
Mm.
And because we were given such an interesting setup and we were so invested in their relationship that, like, we were along for the ride so much so that we didn't see the end game. Like, we didn't see the finish point.
Yeah.
Like you're do just, in most films. Like, you know where a film is going, but you're so invested in the characters and in the now of what is happening that you don't moment. See. Yeah.
It's kudos to that film.
Yes.
This is I mean, it's different to... I don't want to compare it to shit like Black Narcissus, but this is one of the better films we've had in a little while.
Quite a while, probably, yeah.
It's very polished.
Yeah. Well, I gotta say as well, we were watching the Criterion Blu-ray, and it was, like, one hell of a transfer as well, and it's a similar colour palette, I think, because it's early 1950s Technicolor that we'd seen recently in Black Narcissus, and it's that... I think the way that the kind of the pastel kind of washed out color look makes it works so well with the 1950s American suburbia, and in particular when it gets to winter and autumn with like the deep oranges and the reds against like the blues, it makes it look like a fucking Norman Rockwell painting. It's like really Americana, like classic. Cool. It just pops the visuals.
Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about. I wonder if what else we could talk about. Maybe every other character.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we can talk about the mob if you want.
Well, we have our two mains. You've got Carrie and you've got Ron. And then every other character in the film is either... You can lump them into the groups of the upper crust society or the free and easy people. Like, Mick.
And Ron's friend Mick and his wife.
Yeah, they're like kind of easygoing, lovable people, open to... when they first meet Carrie, they're very open with the relationship and welcoming, versus contrast with the upper crust society where everyone is just a fucking cunt. There's literally no other way to say it. We are introduced to these people before, you know, the relationship with Ron happens. Carrie finally goes out to a dinner party. She hasn't really been out since her husband died, and... At the party, Mona, who's supposed to be one of her friends, is just like, oh, blah, 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 your husband dying and all. Like, just is a fucking cunt. Like,
yeah.
I just, why is she friends with these people?
It's not normal. It's not normal.
Just the constant bitchiness and like, backstabbery that happens and just...
It helps to really get behind Ron, though. I mean,
couple's
love, just experiencing all the hate that's going on in her world wants you to have them succeed as a lover so fucking much.
Yeah, that's it. And it's so beautifully contrast with, like, yeah, it's Carrie's world versus Ron's world. And it's, yeah, one is kind of harsh and abrasive and very clean and sterile as well. Like, if you look at it, all the houses and things and the country club they go to, everything's very white and polished and there are mirrors everywhere. Versus when she goes for the dinner party at Mick's place, they... fucking make a table out of like just pieces of wood. Like
I think they're just sitting on the floor, man.
Yeah, and it's like everyone's just playing the piano and getting drunk and having a grand old time, and it's just rustic and kind of dirty. Like not dirty, but like you know what I mean. It's not. Yeah, it's the perfect contrast to you know her world. It's fucking well.
But you can be nice and lovely
in a sterile
environment.
Yeah.
But I thought that. I was waiting. It was moment. I think this is what we were talking about, where you don't care about the ending so much that it's the moment to moment. I was waiting to see what would happen when you finally do get Ron into the cocktail situation.
Like, as in when we actually get when he actually first goes to that party and gets.
Well, the whole time I'm thinking like, how is Ron going to react to like the cocktail party?
Yeah.
And
then when we actually get to that scenario, is that what you're wanting to...
Hang on a second. Nah, shit. I've lost it. Sorry. Nah, move on.
Nope.
I can't remember what I was going to say about that.
Sorry.
I don't know what else to say.
I've got a really stupid what-if scenario.
Okay. Shit.
Okay, so this film takes place in 1955.
Yes.
And... It was established, you mentioned it a little bit earlier that...
Oh, the universal lot.
We're in Hill Valley.
Okay.
It's 1955. Do you think possibly somewhere in this town, on the other side of town, not near the country club, there is a fish, the Enchantment Under the Sea dance is happening.
Oh my god.
And with Doc and Marty McFly.
Well, they are at Hill Valley.
They are. So, and it's 1955, and it's, you know, it's the end of the year. It's you know, winter time, so it's November or whatever, so.
All signs point to yes.
Yeah, that's my L. Really stupid what if. That's my I've had a couple of glasses of wine. Bizarre what if scenario.
That's that really makes no sense. That's silly.
Yes, it is.
I'll entertain it.
But no, well, I'm trying to think, like, what else we can kind of delve into with this film, because, like you were saying, the characters are fairly base and generic, and the story as well is not, you know, you can sum it up in a sentence, but it is the contrasts that really kind of enrich the...
Well, they're not that generic. I mean, the upper-class characters are somewhat generic, but they're just extremes of kind of normal cases you'll find around town. And Ron seems to be an extreme too. So it's just characters written to illustrate
extents,
just to illustrate a point. But I mean, does this work as propaganda? Because it seems like your hero and heroine are breaking away from capitalism in the end.
I don't think it's, you could view it as, I mean, you could if you like really wanted to.
It is championing like but, the idea that you don't want to, your idea of success, if it's getting excess amount of money and a big house and all that sort of shit.
No,
it might be the right idea.
I don't think it's kind of championing that. I think what it is championing is love.
Championing. I keep saying
I've got a cold. Can't pronounce words properly.
I can't. My language is being affected by cold.
I think what it is praising is the idea of love.
Yeah.
Not necessarily putting down one lifestyle over the other. It's the idea of finding love wherever you can and being able to embrace that love and embracing difference, I guess.
Yeah, I think...
This film is an allegory for race relations in America.
But furthermore, I think it was really praising the idea of breaking away from fear.
Yeah.
Pretty much more than anything else, man, because... everyone's happy in this film until fear starts.
Until they presented a change.
Ron, Mick, all those guys in the kind of hippie side of life, they're all fine. They're all happy because they don't really fear much, if anything at all. All of the people that are gossiping, all of the people that are cunts, they are fearful of not having money, of not having... I mean, they're all really worried about...
having stature.
Yeah, they're all really worried about the opinions of others. And that's really what ruined their first round of the love affair.
Back onto, like, I mean, I jokingly said just before that this film was a an allegory for race relations in the US in the 1950s. The idea of change and fear and that. It's interesting to note that this film was actually remade in 2002. It's called Far From Heaven, and it was written and directed by Todd Haynes and starred Julianne Moore.
Oh, Julianne Moore.
Yeah, she was nominated for an Academy Award for her performance. But what the
Have
film...
Have you seen this film?
Yeah.
Okay.
What the film does, instead of having her be a widower and starting a new relationship with a younger man, it's her having a friendship with a black man. So they really actually shine into the whole idea of fear and difference and change in, and shine the light on.
Yeah.
Trying to adapt it to, instead of an idea of a romantic relationship and make age be the difference, let's do it as a... Yeah, make race the catalyst.
That's interesting, because it seems like you can just, depending on the time or the era or the decade, whatever the zeitgeist is of the current generation, you can kind of transpose... You know, Ron, the hippie,
for
a black guy, for, you know, fucking like a gay person maybe.
Yeah.
Whatever. So that's kind of sweet, because back in the 50s, I mean, you don't even see a black guy in this fucking movie.
Yeah, yeah. You could, yeah, he is a... Nowadays, he's a vessel for whatever would represent change, or, you know...
A different contrast ideology.
To this, yeah, a different ideology, perfectly said. Yeah.
Yeah, different lifestyle choice, it's fine. Mm. But, because this film, if you did it exactly that, you would need to change that character.
Yeah.
Because no one would give a fuck.
Yeah, if you did that nowadays, everyone would be like...
Oh, you want to date the gardener? Cool, man.
Well, I mean, the film, Far From Heaven, is still set in the 1950s, but... You know,
nowadays, it's just like, he's got a job, great. That's good.
Yeah, pretty much.
Any job's great.
Yeah. I was actually watching this film, I was kind of wondering if it was remade today and it was strictly this film and it was about an older woman having a relationship with a younger man, like, would it A, still work, and B, is that any, like, who would you cast, I guess? Like, there's no one that would... The woman is easy, you could... Julianne Moore, Kate Winslet, there's a lot of strong, you know, female independent women like that could portray that role. But I kind of started to think, like, we don't have a Rock Hudson. In this film, he's 30 years old. He's the same age as us, and he's so much more of a man.
Oh my god, he's so much more of a man.
He really is.
I feel shit now.
Sorry, but there is no actor that is a Rock Hudson. For our generation, we don't, like, the closest we'd have maybe is Robert Pattinson? Like the
Tom Hardy?
No, but Tom Hardy's in his late 40s.
Oh.
Like, I'm saying, like, yeah, young guy. Like.
Shia LaBeouf?
But could you see Shia LaBeouf playing Ron?
I could see him playing Ron, in particular, a hippie.
Actually, yeah. Like,
he would do that. Maybe. Fucking Third Rock kid.
Oh, Jogo Levitt.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He could probably do it.
Yeah, yeah.
That would work for him. But again, like, you can't be that character. It couldn't even be a black guy now. No one gives a shit about if you're dating
a black guy or
a different race person.
Couldn't even...
Unless it's like an Eskimo, maybe.
Maybe
if it was an Inuit. Like, if they were like a reindeer herder or something.
No, you know what it would have to be? I was going to...
So vastly different.
I was going to say, you know what it'd be? It'd be someone... I fucking hate that I have to say this. It'd be having someone who's, like, Islamic or something. Like, that's what it would be in this day and age.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is a fucking bummer to
that
say.
That is a bummer.
Yeah, but I was just thinking, like, even if it was a lesbian couple thing, like, that... I was going to say that wouldn't work, but then thinking about it, there's this film, actually, coincidentally, also made by Todd Haynes, who did Far From Heaven, the remake... coming out, it's out in the US at the moment, it's coming out here soon, called Carol. It's about an older woman starting up a love affair with a young girl, starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I guess, and apparently it's fucking phenomenal, so yeah. I guess that could work if it was...
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to actually now see that film, to see if it actually, how it weighs in, if it is kind of similar to this.
This is a nice concept.
Yeah.
It's almost like you could have a franchise. Where every decade you release...
All that heaven allows, colon, race.
Yeah.
Gender.
And you just change the character to whatever people are kind of being shitty. I mean, because the Islamic thing is probably right on the mark.
Yeah.
Because there is...
There's
an irrational fucking...
Yeah,
hate
very irrational.
That. So...
Yeah.
And there's an irrational hate in this movie towards a person that's a gardener.
Yeah, so, because he's lower stature than what they used to. Yeah, it's the unknown. It's fear of the unknown, I guess, or the out of the norm. Yeah.
Yeah. This film is awesome.
It really fucking is. But I mean, have you got anything else you want to jump into, or are you ready to move on to trivia?
Yeah, I'm done.
Yep. Alrighty, so let's move on to some trivia then. Sorry, I didn't prep for this, so there's not many, so I'll just read it off the cuff and see what happens. Originally, Douglas Sirk wanted the film to end with Ron's fall down the cliff after he recognised Carrie, leaving it open if Ron would survive or not. But producer Ross Hunter found the ending to be way too depressing and disturbing for the audience.
Yeah, we haven't actually even talked about that, because he falls off a cliff and lands rather heavily.
It was very bizarre, because we're presented with this scene where it's, you know, their relationship breaks down and it's not going to work, But then Carrie has the thing of like, no, true love must prevail. She goes out to meet Ron, but he's not at the house. He's actually out hunting.
It seemed less cliche than that.
Yeah, yeah. There's build up to that. I'm doing the really abbreviated version. Long story short, she's driving away because he's not at the house, but he's up on the hill and in a hurry to go meet her. The snow slips under his foot and he fucking falls off a cliff.
Yeah, like 30 meters.
Really badly. Like, and it is out of nowhere and it just ends with him unconscious, not moving. That was how the director wanted to end the film.
I know, because it fades.
It stayed on his body for like 5 seconds, not moving, and faded to black.
I expected him to get up and kind of like be like, "Ah, oh, fuck! I gotta get her. I gotta get to the car." But no, fade to black.
Yeah.
When it fades to black, you know some shit's gone down.
Yeah, it was. That would have been a hardcore way to end the film. But yeah,
that's a pointless way to end the movie.
Yeah, because you're just like, what the fuck? Because you automatically assume he died. Because it's a massive fall, and he lands on his face.
Like, so the director's like, legitimately, people would think that he might survive. It's 50-50.
There's no way.
There's no way.
Yeah, but he did.
He bounced really
hard. But yeah, the producer, Ross Hunter, said that the ending was too depressing and disturbing for audiences, and therefore he decided to go with the conventional happy ending, which is the one that we're given in the film, that... He comes to, and you know, he's fucked up. Like, they don't pussyfoot around. Like, he fucked himself up.
Yeah, he fucked himself up. But I will say that, it's a good thing you raised this, because we were going to just gloss over this.
Yeah, yeah.
But I will say that the film is exceptional up until that fade to black.
Yeah.
And that ending did seem fucking tacked on. Super tacked on, man.
To the point of, like, it panned over to the window and there's a happy deer there.
Yeah, it didn't feel necessarily wrong, but it didn't feel like it was supposed to be there.
Yeah.
So...
But that being said as well, the fade to black on his fall would have been...
That's even worse.
Jarring as shit. Like, that, yeah... Well, I don't know how you could have ended that.
What an odd choice for a director to make.
A major part of the movie revolves around the fact that Jane Wyman's character, so Carrie, is supposed to be substantially older than Rock Hudson's Ron. In reality, Jane Wyman was only 38 and Rock Hudson was 30 when they made the movie.
Mm.
So only 8 years of difference.
She's more of a MILF then.
And yeah, the only other... main piece of trivia I had was that the film was inducted into the National Film Registry, and so it was preserved in the vault of in the Library of Congress. It got inducted in 1995, so
awesome.
Yeah, it is a piece of film that will live on, which is lovely.
That's right, Chris.
It certainly is, Tom. Yeah. But I guess on that note, we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still available as a 3-disc dual format. Recently got the Blu-ray and DVD upgrade. It was one of the few that there's like 10 titles where Criterion were doing, no, you got to buy DVD and Blu-ray together, until they realised, oh, we shouldn't do that. So it's one of the few ones that is a dual format.
How much more pricey is that?
About $10 more pricey, and so people got kind of annoyed. Yeah. So that's why they... stopped doing dual format and made it so...
This is a capitalist society. We need choice.
Yeah, but and with a kind of nice niche thing like Criterion, they were nice enough to be like, oh, no, sorry, our bad, we fucked up. Like, they listened to the fans, which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
But it does come with the following special features of an audio commentary featuring film scholars John Mercer and Tamar Jeffers McDonald. Rock Hudson's Home Movies from 1992, a groundbreaking essay film about the actor by Mark Rappaport. French television interview with director Douglas Sirk from 1982. Excerpts from Behind the Mirror, a profile of Douglas Sirk, a 1979 BBC documentary featuring rare interviews and footage with the director. Contract Kid, William Reynolds on Douglas Sirk, a 2007 interview with the actor who co-starred in 3 Sirk films, including All That Heaven Allows, as well as trailer and the usual kind of booklets and essays, including one by Rainer Fassbinder. Another huge German surrealist director. talking about how much he loved the movie.
Have we seen any of his films?
No. I actually have never seen any Fassbinder films, and it's something I'm actually really looking forward to.
I'd like to see some surrealism.
I just ordered from during the Criterion Barnes & Noble sale. He made a 4-hour television miniseries that's like set like a future sci-fi series called World on a Wire, and on our Criterion, people recommended that I check that one out, so I've fucking ordered that and cannot wait to sink my teeth into it.
What's that about in particular?
I don't really know. I just watched some weird little trailers, and it's like futuristic sci-fi, crimey, bizarreness. But I'm like, all right.
Oh well, you better put a link to the trailers, because in like fucking, I don't know, some on the website.
If anyone is listening to the our podcast, I'm sure they know the Criterion Collection, and it's worth. Yeah. That one, I think, is in like the 400 or 500. So it's you know, we'll get to it eventually.
Okay, sweet.
But yeah, I guess that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Douglas Sirk's All That Heaven Allows. But next week we'll be back with another Douglas Sirk film, also starring Rock Hudson, called Written on the Wind, also starring Lauren Bacall.
Look at his split.
Yeah, so looking forward to that after seeing this one. But if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, or you also find Rock Hudson or Ron irresistibly attractive and you have strange new feelings that you don't quite know how to explain, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. But other than that, we will see you next week. For this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.